Welcome, everybody. My name is Chris Soth. I'm a screenwriter and graduate of the University of Southern California. I'm the screenwriter of the movie Firestorm and the soon-to-be-released Outrage. You might know me from my other website, milliondollarscreenwriting.com, where you may subscribe to my free newsletter of screenwriting tips. Maybe you have downloaded my ebook or my DVDs on the methods of screenwriting they taught me at USC, of the method of sequencing that I teach is the mini movie method, or maybe you've met me at a live seminar or the Screenwriters Expo. I will be doing a seminar teaching my methods this weekend in Chicago. If you're interested or near there, please email me, chris@hollywoodbyphone.com. And I've pretty much taught ever since grad school while working as a professional screenwriter, both through my own website and my alma mater, USC, and where I met today's guests through the UCLA extension. And I get a lot of questions about a lot of things in teaching, and one thing that people continually ask for since I've started MillionDollarScreenwriting.com, which is all about craft, is career advice and how to advance from their career. And people, the beauty of the internet is people all over the world ask you, how do I connect and how do I, from here in Ohio or here in Chicago or here in New York or here in Singapore and Australia and London, how do I make connections in Hollywood? And the best answer I've been able to come up with so far is what we're doing right now, which is HollywoodByPhone.com. I've put up a special page for this conference today, and I'm going to announce what that is in just a few minutes, and if you're near a computer, you can go there. I started Hollywood by Phone last July, and we've had an interview call today, like the one we're having today, once a week since then. And every week we have a new guest on, and an audience of writers like yourself can listen to a great manager, agent, producer, one of your fellow filmmakers or screenwriters, or, as we have today, one of the great teachers of screenwriting that Los Angeles has to offer. And all of the calls are made available via recorded MP3 to members. And other members of Hollywood by Phone also receive a transcript a few weeks later. So, all of that said, I think we're ready to begin today's Hollywood by Phone interview. I can see that our guest is on the line. So I'm going to mention a few things about the great Billy Murnett. I first met Billy at the UCLA Extension, where I also taught. And I was known as an action-adventure writer. And that genre sort of was in a cyclical downturn, and I decided I should write a romantic comedy. And luckily, I had an idea for one. And the beauty of being a UCLA Extension instructor is you can take courses for free. And Billy's course, writing the romantic comedy, was being offered that term. And I went to sit in that class, and the things that I learned there, I have stolen, of course, for all of my own lectures on love stories and romantic comedies. And the number of times I find myself quoting this man, it's just embarrassing to admit. I don't think Billy even knows this story, but while that romantic comedy that I went to that class to write still remains under my own control, I did meet a student in that class, how's this for a cute meet, and she and I collaborated on a romantic comedy that, if you were to look up my name in Film Tracker, you can see was optioned by a well-known Hollywood actress whose name is there but who I won't mention now. So I've known great success because of this man's teachings, and I'm just thrilled to introduce a WGA screenwriter, novelist, studio story analyst, the author of an upcoming novel, Imagine Me and You, and the man who wrote the book on writing the romantic comedy, which is brilliantly titled Writing the Romantic Comedy. I've never done this before, but we have so many people on the line tonight. Billy is about to show us the love here on the eve of Valentine's Day. So before he does that, I'm going to see if I can unmute the line. And if you can do this, just stand up where you are. I'm going to do it now. And We're going to show him some love. Everybody, I'm going to unmute the line, and on the count of three, we'll all say, show us some love, Billy. Okay, it didn't work. So, Billy Murnett, show us some love. Oh, I'm sorry about that. But there are over 150 people on the line, which is why I think the muting is not working. So, Billy Murnett, welcome to Hollywood by Phone.
Oh, thank you, Chris. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you fine, and that means they can hear you, even if we couldn't hear them all shouting. I know they were.
I'm having a little trouble getting my ear to the phone because my head is so huge now.
as well it should be, and not many people deserve to have a swelled head. But
well, enough about that. Ask me some questions.
Okay. Well, I did do a survey of questions from our crowd, and these are the ones that were most popular. I'm going to try to get through as many of them as we can tonight.
Okay.
And the first one, I think this is a great introductory question. Why romantic comedy? It's a good idea to specialize as a writer in Hollywood and all that, but what drew you to romantic comedy, and why when you chose to specialize, did you pick that?
Well, I think I was ruined for life by the real-life romance of my parents, who are currently in their 80s and still young and in love. In fact, I brought them to a romantic comedy seminar I was doing, and they sat in the back because they were visiting from out of town, and a few people mistook them for Ruth Gordon and Garson Kanin, not knowing that, of course, they were dead. No, seriously, I mean, I had an example of an extremely successful romance in my personal life that kind of really set me up badly for all the romances that I then experienced in my own real life. But I also, from early on, saw a lot of the screwball era stuff, you know, the best of Howard Hawks and those movies, and they made an indelible impression on me, and it just seemed to be something that I related to and enjoyed. And so I kind of continued to be just a student of that genre over the years. And I guess I can confess now, it's just a sidebar, I even made a living for about 7 years as a romance novelist under a female name. But we don't need to go into all of that here. But it's
well,
sort of, you know, it prepped me for doing it in features. And the first spec script that I came out here with some 15 years ago was a romantic comedy, which subsequently got optioned and went through, I think, five different sets of producers until it landed in development hell, where it still resides. But it hasn't soured me on the good effect.
Well, it's rubbing elbows with a lot of my scripts there in hell.
Yeah, yeah.
That segues very nicely into our next question. What are the best romantic comedies? And if you mentioned Howard Hawks, so can we reel off a few titles there for our crowd?
We can, although I have a caveat here. I recently, on my blog, I attempted to do a list of the top 10 greatest American, or just period, greatest romantic comedies. And what I came up against was just a sort of an obvious truism, which is if you really want to start factoring in the screwball era, and the sort of the classic romantic comedies of the past, you're going to run through your 10 fairly quickly, and you're not going to have much room for, you know, everything since. So I have to qualify and say, I think one could make a case that there's a list of two top 10 romantic comedies. One would be specifically for your sort of classic romantic comedies of the pre-war era, and then you could say the top 10 since in what we might call the modern era. So if you want me to reel off some names...
Let's do that. Why not? Right.
My personal top 10 for the pre-war, the screwball era, I would put down certainly The Lady Eve, Preston Sturges, The Shop Around the Corner, which is Lubitsch. That's the movie that was terribly remade as You've Got Mail. Philadelphia Story, classic. The Hawks films, His Girl Friday and Bringing Up Baby. I think Ninotchka qualifies. Certainly The Awful Truth, which many people may remember as the film that made Asta the Terrier a star. And maybe I'd throw in It Happened One Night, just because it was such an influential movie. Possibly my man Godfrey might make that cut. And even a very early Lubitsch film called Trouble in Paradise, which is sort of hard to see but still holds up very well. And then for the modern era, and this is much more controversial because people have many different opinions, I'll just reel off what I put on the blog as my top 10 faves. That would be Billy Wilder's The Apartment, The Graduate, Annie Hall, Tootsie, Moonstruck, Say Anything, When Harry Met Sally, Groundhog Day, Four Weddings and a Funeral, and A Fish Called Wanda.
Now, is that from memory? Because
No.
Greatest.
Now I'm reading.
Okay.
Now I'm reading, just because people do ask, and I like to have it close at hand.
Well, since you've mentioned, let's be sure to say the name of your blog.
Oh, that's Living the Romantic Comedy. And I cover topics related to specifically romantic comedy, but also just screenwriting in general. And, of course, romance in real life, as we call it.
It's so disappointing.
Yeah, well, it can be. Then again, you know, fortunately there are surprises. Yeah.
Compared to what they've given us in the silver screen. So.
Well, that's a problem, yeah.
It really
in a way, my book is about that. I have a protagonist in Imagine Me and You who, like myself, has been sort of benignly poisoned by romantic comedy. And the book, in a way, is an exploration of how romantic comedy in the movies can not necessarily put you in a good place for real-life romance. But, yeah, we'll stay away from fiction.
Absolutely. Here on the eve of Valentine's Day, let's not be too bitter.
Yeah.
Let's invite the ladies to all open up that heart-shaped box of chocolates and the
Absolutely.
And slip into that lingerie. So.
Yeah.
That is quite a list. And 20. I mean, when you said pre-war, I didn't realize that you were going to give us the modern one. Let's start with The Apartment, which I view as such a timeless classic.
Apartment is a great sort of. It's 1950, I think, is the actual year on that. Or is it 60? Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. It's either 59 or 60. It is somewhere in there, 59, 60. And it's kind of almost the beginning of the modern era, in a sense, because it's got a real dark, cynical kind of a shell, and, of course, a warm and fuzzy center, you know. But it's one of the first sort of modern romantic comedies to place its romantic comedy in a very realistic milieu and even a slightly sordid kind of a situation. If you remember the film, do we need to go into details?
No, I don't think we do, but it was corporate, and that first shot is over all those desks, and that it was the first sort of workplace romantic comedy that I can think of. You're right. It is modern, certainly in that sense.
Yeah, and the situation that its protagonist faces, Jack Lemmon, is one where he's in a very morally compromising situation, and the woman that he becomes involved with actually becomes suicidal at one point in the movie. So it's not your, you know, run-of-the-mill, frothy, you know, boy-meets-girl kind of story. It really has some bite to it.
No, and it's great.
Yeah.
A favorite of mine as well. So I'm going to pause just a moment and mention to everybody in the sound of my voice that web page that I mentioned has gone live. And if you want to know a little more about Hollywood by Phone, Creative Screenwriting Magazine, which is sponsoring this call and through which many of you came to the call, has made a free month of Hollywood by Phone service and 4 to 6 more calls like this available to you at www.hollywoodbyphone.com/csbonus, and I'll mention that once or twice more during the call. I love this next question because it's really about the craft and really an insightful rom-com question. This actually was our most popular question, and it has to do all about the balance of characters in a rom-com. Mm-hmm. A lot of people have noticed that there's a very even split between boy and girl, and then sort of a related question is, who's the antagonist then? Who's the bad guy with these two characters having so much screen time? Is that a third character? So where do we get our opposition in a romantic comedy, and how do you divvy up the screen time or the white space on the page?
It's kind of two questions in one, so let me first go after this issue of who's the antagonist. Quite often, there's kind of two conventional ways to construct a romantic comedy story in terms of the conflict. One is you've got two people who fall in love, and then either one or the other of them has some kind of external conflict that creates a problem, creates an obstacle for them. The other, obviously, the other way to go is the beast within, you know. Annie Hall, Truth About Cats and Dogs, and any number of films come to mind where there's really no reason why the two people can't get together, but it's a problem that is an inner conflict or a personal issue that one or the other protagonist has. And of course, obviously, the ideal is a kind of a mix and match, you know, where you have both an external conflict and something internal to sweeten the conflict. But in terms of the antagonist, there is a way of looking at the romantic comedy that says, really, the antagonist is love, you know, is the power of love and how love affects the characters. You can look at the construct of a romantic comedy as, instead of boy meets girl, it's character meets love. Then B, character has to struggle with love and either accept or reject it. And then C, character accepts and is transformed by love. So that's another way of looking at this issue of the antagonist. But in the first two versions that I talked about, more conventionally, you know, you have something like Arthur where it's like, if you want to love this girl, you're going to lose your fortune. There's an external conflict. Then you can have something more like Wedding Crashers where it's, if you really want to love one girl, then you have to give up your life as a womanizer, and that's more of an internal conflict, et cetera, et cetera. Is that making sense?
Absolutely, and what you said there is, I mean, obviously when boy meets girl, that girl is so often the embodiment of love.
Right, and so sometimes one or the other character can be seen as the antagonist, but it's really because they've got that, you know, that they are the agent of the love antagonist. They have the virus.
And we don't, and we don't have to think of this as a villain. They just have an antagonistic relationship.
Yeah. Now, but it seems like buried within the question you asked is a secondary question that comes up a lot for me in various classes and seminars, which is, who is your point of view character? Meaning, you know, so many movies need to be very firmly based in one protagonist's point of view, and that is, I'd say, as a reader, I can tell you it's one of the smartest ways to write a story in terms of getting an audience and a reader involved, is make sure your script is really solidly grounded in one protagonist's point of view. But even though, generally speaking, we go one way or the other in a romantic comedy, you do have to have a balance of two protagonists, meaning the strongest romantic comedies are those where the audience may, you know, one character may be the sort of primary point of view character, but you do get enough familiarity with the other character that you can, you know, root for them to become a couple and really care about them both. There's only a few romantic comedies in the history of the genre that kind of are the exceptions that prove the rule, and those are famously When Harry Met Sally and Sleepless in Seattle. Those are two romantic comedies where, to this day, I've never gotten a satisfactory answer. In the case of Sleepless, even from the writer, Jeff Arch, I've never really gotten a clear answer on whose movie it is, supposedly. I mean, those are very evenly split stories. But most of the time, you'll find that it's wiser and it works better to at least favor one versus the other.
Right. So in those stories you just mentioned, that we could say they're both the protagonist and they're both the antagonist.
Yeah, it really, you make a very good case on either side. You know. But
right.
But even I'll think of something more recent that was successful. If you look at Juno, which is a hybrid, it's a coming of age movie, but it is sneakily enough a romantic comedy simultaneously. Clearly it's Juno's movie. I mean, Pauly Bleecker is totally boss, but he's not the one that we really get to hang with in that movie.
Right. Okay, and it's titled after her too, which is a big hint.
Mm-hmm.
At USC, I think they would tell you that When Harry Met Sally is Harry's story, just as an aside. He's the subject of the sentence in the title, and he has that belief that men and women can't be friends. That is sort of
right. He's the character who's ultimately transformed the most, although she does go through an arc of her own.
Right.
So yeah, you could make a case that ultimately it's Harry's
but belief. That's film school stuff.
So. Yeah, and if you look at it just in terms of screen time, it's a little harder case to make than you might think.
Right, because she may even have more screen time.
Could be.
Yeah. So, this brings me to the subtitle of your book, which I don't mention when I say it. I feel like even you mainly refer to it as writing the romantic comedy.
Sure.
But what is the subtitle? Because I think it's so smart and so sums up romantic comedy and rhymes. It is genius on at least three levels.
Well, if you mean in terms of there's two subtitles. One is From Cute Meat to Joyous Defeat.
That's the one I'm talking about.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right. Yeah. And that refers to, two of the so-called primary beats of the romantic comedy. I always feel like I'm really asking for trouble when I start talking about those, those plot points. But they're there,
Well, I had never heard the phrase "the joyous defeat" before I took.
Well, that's my own. Yeah. That's my own. But it's there because it describes the resolution of most romantic comedies.
It absolutely does. I think it's genius.
Well, it's that sense that even though it's a quote-unquote happy ending, in a good romantic comedy, someone has had to sacrifice something. Something has to be given up, even if it's just one's own conception of who one is. There's a change that's made, and it often has really serious consequences. And there's also, especially in the screwball era, you see a lot of endings where girl gets boy, and boy is kind of sitting there going, oh, great. It's just a little sense of, you've done the crime, now you're going to have to do the time. And that seems to always be implicit in those happy endings.
In the screwball era, I think Peter Bogdanovich is famous for saying this. It was always the girl going after the guy. And that was so charming, and we rarely see that now.
Well,
and
it's the original reversal that got the whole thing going, yeah.
Right. And But that phrase, joyous defeat, just cued me in so much because, as you say, in the previous example, Harry kind of is defeated by Sally.
Yeah.
He has to give up that idea that they can't be friends. And he has to surrender to being lovers. And he does lose something but gains so much more. And so he is defeated, but he is joyous.
And I think, it's just addressing something that's real about relationships in life, which is, when you get involved in a committed monogamous relationship, most men would, perhaps privately to their buddies or whatever, or in their darkest moments, they think, this is where it stops for me. I'm out of the game now. This is the one woman I'll be with. And, women, on the other hand, have to reconcile themselves to the fact that, this is the guy. This is who I've got. Heaven help me. I'm with him. So on both sides, I think it really does reflect something about just, human nature when it comes to monogamous relationships.
Absolutely. I thought that was so smart. Of course, I had heard Cute Meat before, but never Joyous Defeat until taking your class and reading your book.
Yeah, there's a lot of dickering about the cute meat. I call it the cute meat, and evidently the original phrase that was bandied about in Hollywood was they have to meet cute. So, that's a nitpick that comes.
Hey. Meeting cute. I have an embarrassing story about using the phrase "cute meat" in mixed company where it was misunderstood.
Oh dear.
So they thought I was saying it in the meat spelling. So that's the advantage of meeting cute.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
Exactly.
I like that. Good. Yeah.
So there's a comic misunderstanding for your next. And speaking of comic misunderstandings, our next question is all about comedy. And I remember you saying that the two big problems with romantic comedy are it's not romantic and it ain't funny.
I'm referring to the spec market. And
right.
I have to say, as a reader, when I'm not writing, I read, and I work for the studios. I'm currently doing a stint at Universal as a story analyst. And I've read something like 6,983 scripts since I first moved out here 15 years ago.
But who's counting?
Yeah, but who's counting? And I wish I was making that number up, but it's probably pretty close.
Wow.
And so here's the thing. I mean, you do see certain patterns and things. And one of the things that I've noticed is that quite often with romantic comedies, there's a fundamental misunderstanding of what the audience for the genre it really wants and what they're asking for. One thing is romance, meaning they actually want to see romantic situations, meaning things where people's passions are really involved. And they want to have laughs, laughs out loud, ha-ha laughs, as opposed to smiles and smirks. They really want comedic set pieces, and they want scenes that will make them laugh. And all too often, writers of romantic comedy neglect one and or both of those sort of primary attributes when they get caught up in presenting their story.
Boy, do they.
Yeah.
I want to delve more into comedy, but I'm going to mention that one of the surprises we have up at hollywoodbyphone.com/CSBonus is the first ever Hollywood by Phone discussion boards are launched there, and I'm going to host a chat about this call with Billy over the next couple of days. Perhaps I can prevail upon him to check in once or twice himself.
Sure.
The next week.
That'd
or
be
so.
Fun. Yeah.
We've been to have discussion boards for some time now, and I'm pleased to say they are launched at hollywoodbyphone.com/CSBonus. So, a lot of questions about comedy. How do we make it funny? How do we get the laughs? What are your favorite devices for doing it? Is it wordplay or malapropism? We had this question in many various forms with sort of a variant on it being how'd they do it old school and how about all this broad and gross out humor that we're seeing now?
Okay, that's many, many questions. Do we go back and break it down?
Let's
start with the first few.
How do we make it funny?
All right. Well, you know, if there was such a thing as a rule book for comedy, every writer would have it, but it would actually only be a few pages long. I mean, most comedy is based purely and simply in the concept of reversal, meaning you're led in one direction and then you get a surprise that takes you someplace else. So everything from, you know, last night I shot an elephant in my pajamas, and what he was doing with my pajamas, I'll never know. To, you know, the whole premise and execution of most comedies is based in reversal. And romantic comedy tends to tweak a lot of very potent reversals. One is the idea of private matters becoming public, or genders becoming reversed, or civilized people going primal and more primitive in the way they are, or humans who are become more mechanical. It's, you know, a lot of different elements of things that get turned inside out. But usually when I'm trying to get people to go after A, what makes a comedy personal to them, and B, what makes it funny, is invariably I say try to think of the most painful, humiliating, embarrassment or embarrassing experience you've ever had with someone of the opposite sex, and that's how we'll get to funny. You know, the premise of most good comedic humor is rooted in real life behavior, things that really put you in an extreme situation and push your buttons emotionally and really give you a hard time. And the trick in comedy, obviously, is for other people watching it, they both get the empathy for the pain that you're in and the wonderful distance that enables them to laugh at it. It's like that famous Mel Brooks line about, I get a hangnail, that's tragedy. You fall down an open sewer and break your neck, that's comedy. So this idea of a personal experience that can be awful, that is then rendered as honestly and as unflinchingly as the writer can manage it, is kind of where a lot of humor resides. We want to see people suffer the way we've suffered in very human ways and then watch them try to wriggle their way out of these situations. And I think you really relate to that a lot, and you get a chance to laugh at it because, fortunately, in this particular case, it's not you. So a lot of comedy comes from taking things very seriously. And if you look at the protagonists of most romantic comedies, they are not usually Jim Carrey-like muggers. You know, they tend to be, Ben Stiller is, I guess, a modern kind of exemplifier of this. He's a guy who's really, really having a hard time in the movies that he's in. He's not cracking jokes. He's not, you know, letting fly with witticisms. He's just very believably, in his good movies, in a situation that really matters a great deal to him. And it's actually his investment in it that raises the stakes and brings on the humor.
I'm put in mind of that that crying jag he goes on after losing Mary, and there's something about Mary. he actually does go through hell, but plays it relatively straight.
There you go. Yeah.
Yeah. And of course, you know, in the early part of that movie, goes through hell as well, in a very genital maiming way.
Right.
And I guess that serves as a segue then. Well, now what about this recent trend to sort of push the envelope taste wise and for broad humor and bodily humor and gross out humor?
Well,
we certainly
didn't see that
under the Hays Code.
Yeah, it goes hand in hand with what's become a more popular variant on the traditional romantic comedy form, which is the male POV romantic comedy. And I nickname it the macho chick flick, because certainly in Judd Apatow's formula, even though there's a lot of gross-out humor and a lot of sexual frankness and a lot of explicit stuff that gets a lot of laughs, when you peel that away, again, at the core of the movie, there's a real sweetness and innocence to his protagonists. If you look at both Steve Carell in 40-Year-Old Virgin and Seth Rogen in Knocked Up, these are really lovable guys. They're not Hefnerites, you know, even though Seth's friends, for example, are doing a skin porn site. He himself is sort of like, he's a big puppy dog, actually. So there's that combination of raunchy and sweet that has made these things palpable, which is, by the way, why I think Ben Stiller's last movie did not do very well, because actually the remake of Heartbreak Kid was so glaringly misogynistic throughout and so kind of mean-spirited, it failed to get that combo of sweet and raunchy operative. But anyway, my long-winded answer to your simple question is the raunchy, sweet, male point of view comedies are, in fact, romantic comedies, but they appeal to more of a male audience and more of a contemporary audience because they're not afraid to take on the kinds of issues that are, you know, we're dealing with in 2008 and can sort of, they have the license to get laughs out of stuff that even 10 years ago would have been considered just, you know, too raunchy to consider.
Okay. And so you're foreseeing more of the same?
Well, I'm not just foreseeing. Now that the strike is over and the deluge is upon us, I can guarantee you that we will be seeing Knocked Ups on a sort of a every other week basis for a while, because anytime something is really successful, invariably everyone goes for it. So yeah, love it, hate it, we're in for more.
Okay, and that puts me in mind of a couple of things. Now, what about the original Heartbreak Kid then? Did that succeed?
That was a kind of it wasn't a big hit, but it did okay in its day. But that the big difference is that that film was actually of an era, sort of the new Hollywood zone in the 70s, where protagonists were a little riskier. There wasn't such a sense of having to protect the leading man so much. I mean, basically, in the original Heartbreak Kid, Charles Grodin, he's wrong, you know. He's R-O-N-G. He's not a well man. You know, there's a real problem with that character. So when he gets his just desserts in that film, it has a very satisfying black comedy feel to it. And I think that the difference is they had the courage of their convictions. They said, you know, here's a guy who's going to go after the wrong woman and get himself into more trouble than he was in before. And let's see him be careful what he wishes for. Let's see it happen and take it in. I think in the new version they were so concerned with making the Ben Stiller version of that character sympathetic that they went too far. They put all the onus on his newlywed wife, made her into this just horrific harridan, and they kind of took the very point of the whole movie inside out and you know, shot themselves in both feet.
I certainly remember that now. They were sort of bending over backwards, and I do remember Grodin being very dark.
Yeah, and yeah, he was, you know, he's basically, you kind of watch him the way you watch, you know, a bad car accident in slow motion. You can't believe he's going to do the things he's doing, but he's doing them. So, you know, it's that difference between, you know, the old argument about sympathetic versus empathetic and compelling. You know, he's not exactly a paradigm, but he, by virtue of his credibility and the fact that you just believe that he believes in what he's doing, you're fascinated by him nonetheless. And I think, you know, studios and writers these days are a little less inclined to take chances with characters like that. I mean, it's sort of what's, to go into another genre for 2 seconds, it seems to be the issue with There Will Be Blood. I mean, Daniel Day-Lewis's performance is just stratospheric. Nobody argues with the fact that this is one of the great performances maybe in film history, but the character is so difficult for people to relate to because they're just not used to seeing someone so quote-unquote unlikable in a leading role.
Absolutely. And the Academy doesn't like an unsympathetic character. Or
yeah, but they're going to give it to him.
I think
the movie won't get it, but he'll get that. They got
okay.
It.
All right, well, I'll invite you into the Hollywood by Phone Oscar pool then.
Okay.
We'll see how things sort out. Well, the next thing that all of our questioners want to know about, of course, is sex. They want to know when to have it and how to handle it. But I think they mean in their screenplays.
Yes, okay. We'll talk about screenplay sex. There's absolutely no rule whatsoever for the when. I mean, traditionally, in your more conventional romantic comedy, sex has tended to land squarely in the middle. It's often been a kind of a midpoint beat for those kinds of movies. But if you look say what?
People specifically asked that. They said, mm-hmm. you know, the sex in my rom-com seems to be coming early or late, or which, you know, is a problem in the real world too. But it, you know, it's coming at the end of Act One, or it's coming far too late into the movie, is this a problem? So they really, I think they'll be glad to hear it's not necessarily a problem.
Well, I guess the real question is what's motivating the sex, meaning like what is the sex signifying? What's it about? You know, obviously they're not, these people who are asking the question are not throwing in sex just to have, you know, a sex scene. You got to think what is the sexual act signifying and where is it, what's it doing in terms of development of the story. But anyway, just case in point, Knocked Up has its sex, you know, end of Act One or even before the actual end of the first act. I mean, there are sex scenes later in the movie, but they're not as crucial, obviously, as the first ones. So, you know, that certainly puts a spanner in the works in terms of sex having to be anywhere in particular. But what was the second part of the question?
And I think Jerry Maguire, they make love at the end of Act One as well, and then
yeah.
Harry at the midpoint, and I feel like that's an excellent modern romantic comedy.
Mm-hmm.
But
how to handle sex, was that the part?
How to write it? How to, you know,
well, again,
put together,
you know,
a good sex.
Sex that is just generic sex. Who cares? You know, I mean, I don't want to see another hand clenching a sheet. Do you? I mean, it's...
Well, in my personal life, but no, not in the movie.
Yeah, but I mean, on screen, I think we've all gotten to the point where, you know, what's nice about the raunchy but sweet, you know, having lived through the year of Apatow, is that, and Sex in the City before it,
right.
is that we can deal with it. You know, we can deal with condoms and, you know, the paraphernalia and God knows what, you know, all different aspects of the actual act, but the handling of it, all I can say that is imperative is, I don't know about you, but when I have sex, I don't really stop being me. Meaning, the characters in your movie, if they're having sex, it should reveal something about character, I would hope. You know, it's the most fun sex scenes, and the ones that really get laughs, and the ones that are kind of involving are the ones where people are being people. And I think that the only thing that would make a sex scene bad in a movie, or at least in a spec script, would be one where it is just that montage, or, you know, the hand clenching the sheet, or just something sexy. But no, you want to see what kind of real intimacy, as in people exposing who they are, as opposed to just exposing skin, comes out of this sex scene. Otherwise, why go there? You know, I mean, it's, if you're going to do it with character. And if not, then, you know, show us the before and the after, because that can often be just as involving.
And fireworks in between.
Yeah, that's right. Just cue the fireworks.
Okay. I think that's great advice. I mean, of course you have your prurient interest of wanting to watch those characters have sex, but you really want to watch those characters have sex.
There's a show that's on the internet. There's a show that's on the internet called Quarter Life.
Yes.
Are you familiar with it?
I heard about it. Not a viewer.
It's an Ed Zwick, what's his name, that team, the guy.
Herskovitz. Marshall Herskovitz and Ed Zwick.
Exactly. The guys who did 30-something originally. And it's going, ironically, they had pitched it as a TV series. They couldn't sell it. They put it up online. It became very popular. Now it's going to be a TV series. But they had a quote-unquote sex scene a couple of weeks ago online where, you know, a lot of the storylines had been building up to this big moment of will this woman and this guy, is it going to happen? Will they do it? And they had this wonderful scene in the bedroom where they kind of started to get into it, and both the man and the woman became so self-conscious over what they were doing that they had to stop. And everything kind of went wrong in a very realistic way. And they decided to just sleep together, ultimately. And, of course, in the subsequent episode, they woke up in the morning and went at it like fiends. But, you know, that's besides the point. The actual sex scene itself was kind of excruciating in a wonderful way. And you got to see people sort of acting like, you know, you and me. You know, stuff was going on that was would have been considered wrong or not romantic or, you know, somehow not sexy in maybe a traditional movie. But, you know, just the fact that they were able to take that risk and show how things screw up and how people get caught kind of, you know, acting, fronting, and then their fronting is exposed, and then they have to reveal who they really are, and things go in a different direction. I thought it was great. And that's the kind of stuff that people respond to. People respond to seeing something that reminds them of their real life. And certainly
absolutely.
In the sexual sphere, you know, that's got to work.
And just as they, I mean, a generation ago, they were all talking about a 30-something was really right out of their life.
Mm-hmm.
I think enough people can identify with that.
Sure.
It'll be successful as well. I'm going to pause for a minute and say that a lot of people were, I'm getting some emails actually about the ebook that I promised people who were live on the call tonight. That's an ebook that is the transcriptions of the first 5 episodes of HollywoodByPhone.com, and that's downloadable at that same website that I keep mentioning, HollywoodByPhone.com/CSBonus. So thanks again to Creative Screenwriting Magazine for getting you guys on the call, and you can get a good look there at what Hollywood by Phone is like and all about by reading our first 5 interviews. So a lot of people are asking this, and I think it says something about our own demographic. This is also a very popular question. What about the baby boomers? What about romantic comedies that are pitched at people our age? Billy, I think you and I are roughly the same age or within a few years of each other.
That would be 39, is that correct?
29, I thought for sure.
You know, I'm glad
Superbad,
you asked.
That was the one for me.
Yeah, I'm glad you asked this because people forget how much money Something's Gotta Give made. I mean, that was a really successful romantic comedy. And yes, it worked because they had Nicholson, of course, and Diane Keaton. But nonetheless, it did open a door, or at least let's just say the door is ajar a little bit, for stories that do have older protagonists. Obviously, you can't always get Jack and Diane. But yeah, you know, the audience is getting older. There are people that can be wooed back into the multiplexes if something like that is out there. And I think there's certainly room for, if you want to call it, boomer-related romantic comedy. Sure, because there's also a hell of a lot of actresses of a certain age that would love to be working. And
right.
If you can come up with something that, you know, that makes sense, it's no longer verboten at all.
Well, it seems like the first hurdle is a bunch of studio executives who think that the boomers won't turn out.
Yeah, I think I think they're kind of up against it, meaning they know less and less about who's going to turn out for what. You know, the old William Goldman maxim is just becoming more and more proven, prescient. You know, nobody knows anything.
Absolutely.
I think if you were to pitch a romantic comedy as it's another something's got to give, if they were raising the flag of, oh my God, they're over 40, you would kind of mute that button on the executive list, meaning you'd at least be able to have something. They always love it when you can compare. And so there's a movie that's a hit, was a big hit, and used older protagonists. So just go armed with that title, and I think you'd at least have something to enter into a dialogue as opposed to stop.
Well, that would be great. As an aging baby boomer myself, I'd like to be drawn back in to a rom-com that speaks to my issues. And then a lot of people sort of ask this question in various phrasings, and that is, if on one level, at some level, we all know that this must end with boy gets girl, how do we keep the suspense and keep the audience guessing? And is it permissible once in a while for the boy to not get the girl, for them?
Absolutely.
Them to
end up part of the the classics that prove the exceptions that prove the rule would be, of course, Annie Hall itself, which is kind of the paradigm for the modern romantic comedy, ends in a breakup. Shakespeare in Love ends up with its protagonists not together. There have been a number of them. And then you have something like Eternal Sunshine, which, although it wasn't a huge moneymaker, has become a really beloved cult movie and maybe influential in ways that we're not even seeing yet. Instead of the characters either being together or not, you've got that just marvelously poignant ending of a decision being made. Well, should we try this, knowing what we know? You know, can we even think that we might get there? You know, so I don't think it's imperative that you have a couple literally end up together. I think people mistake the literal for the figurative. All that really matters in a romantic comedy is that the primacy of this relationship and the importance of this relationship be acknowledged. You know, Shakespeare in Love ends with, well, you're going across the sea, but you and I are going to be together for eternity, as he then, you know, proceeds to write some of the most famous romantic comedies ever written with her name, you know, in them. So, I mean, there are ways to have people end up together, quote unquote. That doesn't mean that they really are getting married or sailing off into the sunset together. Now, if you're talking about how do you engage an audience in the game of the whole thing if supposedly we know the ending going in? Well, now you're getting at the real nut of the whole genre, which is, you know, it's a genre that unfortunately is resolutely predictable in its basic strokes. But I would just direct people who seem stymied by that to the thousand upon thousands of thrillers and mysteries and action movies and every other kind of genre movie that's ever been made where, you know, tell me you don't know that Die Hard is going to end with, you know, Bruce Willis, the last man standing. I mean, it's, hello.
Yeah.
So,
you just gave me a great idea, though.
Yeah, I think that if you approach a romance, here's the thing, and I'm kind of stepping off your question into my kind of, this is the subject that's sort of on my mind and in front of me. There's a prevalence of adhering slavishly to the idea of what a romantic comedy is. I think this is really the issue. A.O. Scott in the New York Times just a week or so ago, did a piece where he was basically going, geez, this genre's gone to shit. Like, boy, all these terrible movies coming out, and isn't it a shame? And, you know, how did we get here? And just sort of in casual passing, almost in the middle of that article, he notes that Knocked Up and Juno were two of the biggest successes in the past year. And then he kind of goes off it because that's not his bone to pick. But I'm going, Guy, those are romantic comedies. That is the new romantic comedy, is something like Knocked Up and Juno. These are movies that are wildly successful. But the point is, they don't come into the movie theater with I'm an old-fashioned date movie tattooed across them. You know, they don't have this, you know, obsessive need to start a movie with the premise of she's looking for Mr. Right or he's never met a girl that he can be serious about. They come in with a story idea. They come in with a concept that's larger than simply being a romantic comedy. And I persist, if you look at the list of the romantic comedies more in the modern era that have really kind of stayed with us and that we keep coming back to, they tend to be the ones that have a high concept or some kind of a take or some other story idea wrapped around their romantic comedy through line, like Groundhog Day, like Tootsie, like The Graduate, or, you know, films that they're not just, they don't start out in a dating pool. You know, they tell romantic love stories and romantic comedy stories, but within the context of a smarter, more intelligent, or original story idea. Enchanted is a romantic comedy. You know, it looks like a Disney fairy tale, and it is. But it's a rom-com heaven, practically, in terms of it hitting all the standard beats where it hits them. But look at this wonderful, imaginative story idea that it came in on. So I'm always trying to get people to look at writing a romantic comedy almost as if that's not what they're writing. You know, go for character, go for a concept, and let the love story develop as it would. But don't go after that, you know, the one that we all know, which ends up with somebody rushing to the airport in the end. That's not the romantic comedy that's going to work now.
Oh,
have I ranted enough? That's my little rant.
you ranted beautifully, and you actually sort of stole my last question because I had A.O. Scott all locked and loaded.
Oh, okay.
Ready for you here.
Well, I can say more. You know, give me a question. I'll go.
Don't worry. There will be more. Just as we've been speaking, I've had a couple of questions come in via email.
Mm-hmm.
I am.
Okay.
And I remembered this made me remember your class and. You spoke about Pretty Woman as an iconic film, and is it still, as we're speaking now, sort of the biggest box office rom-com ever?
I think it still wears the crown. Yeah, I'd have to go check on thenumbers.com, which is, you know, the people who track this stuff.
Right.
But Pretty Woman, last time I looked, was they adjust the ticket prices for inflation and all that, so I'm pretty sure Pretty Woman is still number one. I think the one that's kind of crept up on it, oddly enough, is There's Something About Mary, which shows you, if anything, there you go. There's the story of the modern era. You know, that's the one that's like breathing down its neck for prominence. But yeah, Pretty Woman is, you know, come on, it's like the greatest guilty pleasure romantic comedy there is. Cause
well, the question really was, can you explain the success? Because I think this is a question coming from a man who may not get it. Though I've had female students who said to me, Pretty Woman is my favorite movie, and any woman who says that Pretty Woman is not her favorite movie is a liar.
Hmm.
So they seem very committed.
Right. Well, you know, the reason that has worn as well as it does is, well, for one thing, we have to give, you know, our props to star power. You know, it is Julia Roberts and Richard Gere, and it was
absolutely
that made her a star. She was phenomenal in that role. But in terms of the script itself, it's kind of your classic fairy tale. You know, it's your Cinderella story, and it's your classic American archetype, the whore with a heart of gold, you know. And it goes after what could have been a very dark story in a very weirdly upbeat way. And it's just an extremely well-written, well-directed version of that sort of almost mythic story, you know, of the girl from nowhere who suddenly, you know, who loves her way to the top, and the guy who can be reformed, you know, the corporate raider who turns out to be a Prince Charming after all. So, I mean, there's something about the very kind of simplicity of the archetypes, the humor of the writing, and then these great star performances have really locked it in on some. I mean, they really, they had lightning in a bottle, and they just really went after it in a way that has an undeniable pull.
As much as we can explain it, that's probably is the best explanation we're ever going to have, and it will just keep making money.
Yeah. There. Well, there's worse, you know, worse things could happen.
Absolutely. Well, I'm going to mention once more that if today's call has interested you at all in Hollywood by Phone, you can go to hollywoodbyphone.com/csbonus. And that CS is for Creative Screenwriting. I just want to thank them for making this call available to their constituency today. On a usual Hollywood by Phone call, it's a smaller crowd, and we usually take our questions live, which is a lot of fun, and you get to interact and network with the producers, agents, and filmmakers. And the ebook that I mentioned is at that same page. And if you do actually sign up for your free month of Hollywood by Phone that Creative Screenwriting is making available, you'll be taken to another page where you can download audio from one of our other interviews with Jason Blumenthal, which was a couple of months ago. And in a month or so, you'll be a member with full benefits, and we will throw open the archives to you. And then I'm going to give you the last question, Billy. Are you ready?
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Okay, because I know you have to get going tonight. So you responded to A.O. Scott, I think quite beautifully, and refuted his thesis, and that was the first part of this question that came to us from Laurie Stoner, which I want to thank her for.
Mm-hmm.
She says as well, in your book, Writing the Romantic Comedy, From Cute Meat to Joy's Defeat, that ends with the year 2000. Now, was that when you published it or finished writing?
Yeah.
And you called 2000 an open question. I remember when you taught the class, you sort of broke it down by decade and said, here's
mm-hmm.
what happened each decade.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now we're 8 years in to the romantic comedy, so I'm going to ask you to say, has the question closed a little bit? Can we do we have enough perspective to say
yeah,
what it's about
do.
Now?
I think
and,
we do. In
and
fact,
then I'll ask
I'm
you about the future.
Yeah, my agent is currently negotiating with HarperCollins to try to get us permission to do a newly revised and expanded, you know, writing the new romantic comedy or whatever, you know, an update on the book. I have my fingers crossed and hope that we'll be able to do so, because one of the things I want to write about is obviously this male point of view romantic comedy, which has been the single most significant development in this decade. It kind of started back in the late 90s when you had There's Something About Mary and a couple of films of that ilk. But, you know, we've discussed it, the Apatow movies, of which I think 40-Year-Old Virgin is probably the best and destined to become sort of a classic. That movie just really holds up well. Have you seen it recently, Chris?
I haven't seen it in a while. I don't think I saw it in its original.
Yeah, I think you'll be, when you go back to it, you'll find it compulsively watchable. It's just one of those movies. But anyway, if there's a tendency or a trend or anything like that, it's that to expand its audience, the genre has sort of shifted and gravitated towards the male point of view. And those seem to be the movies in the 2000s that are really grabbing the audience, and which leads me to the next sort of predictable point. The only thing that's really bugging me about the new male point of view romantic comedy is that the women are weak. We need better, stronger, more compelling female parts for this thing. And it seems to me that that'll be the next natural outgrowth, and maybe Juno is the beginning of that trend, meaning start to see a different kind of woman on screen that maybe harkens back in a way to the original screwball heroine, in that she's autonomous and has some real strength and some real fire and bite to her. It
and
would
she
be great.
Crack wise.
Yeah, it would be great to see, somebody like a Catherine Hegel, or someone like her, you know, have a part that was really a part. I mean, she's wonderful and Knocked Up, but there's not much of a character there.
And what about 27 dresses? Because that seems to be very old school.
Yeah, there she is stuck in an old school rom-com with not much to do, unfortunately. But, you know, if you gave her a great piece of material, a real role that was as powerful or as funny and compelling as Steve Carell's in Virgin, you know, then now we're talking. You know, then we're getting back into something that is a little more balanced and thus a lot more fun, I think.
So the trend seems to be for a male-driven, or at least one that a guy can go to and still enjoy.
Yeah, I mean that's what's happened basically is the date movie has become a province for the male as well as the female, and that's a done deal. I mean we've already been through it. It's happening. It's all over. It's going to continue for a while, and all I'm saying is I'm looking a little bit into the next step. I'm thinking, well, great. And hopefully, God willing, we'll start to see some movies where the women come back to the fore so that we can get, you know, everyone misses that Tracy Hepburn, Gable, Claudette Colbert, whatever, you know, that kind of wonderful friction and great repartee and energy that used to come out of romantic comedies where you really felt that the man and the woman were equally matched. And I think if women, it's kind of amazing and wonderful, there are at least three women screenwriters nominated for an Oscar this year, including, of course, Diablo Cody, who's probably going to win that. It's a good sign, you know. I mean, hopefully we'll start to, you know, we'll get the answer to Apatow, and that can only revitalize the genre.
That would be tremendous. I hadn't done that count, but that's great to hear that so many women are being recognized and nominated.
Yeah. Good.
Well, I think it remains to say thank you to our guest, and I'll just say, Billy, there for every question I read, there were 10 more that we could do
well,
at the time.
Well, let me invite all your listeners to my blog, because I'd love to have you there to comment and take part in it. You can find it through billymernit.com. Just click on the blog box. And there's all kinds of discussion about romantic comedy that goes on there on a weekly basis. So if you like the forum and you want to get into it some more with me, that's where you can find it.
And I've got to say, unlike this blogger, Billy is an assiduous poster. Long, thick, content-rich.
Well, don't scare them off. I'm trying to cut them down.
They're all gold.
I'm trying to make them not quite so lengthy. So, yeah.
Well,
pictures?
But you
have
really,
pictures?
Exactly. And if there's a romantic comedy out there, you do post on it. And
I try to.
You're very diligent. And then we have to mention your novel, which is coming out. And when can we get a hold of that?
I'm very excited. I'm very nervous. It comes out in April. It's called Imagine Me and You, and it's being published by Random House, which is great, in one of their sort of tonier imprints called Shea Arhart. And it's out April 8th. And I'll probably do some readings or signing things here in L.A. and hopefully one in New York in April or early May. And it's a romantic comedy. And like I said, it kind of, in a funny way, it deals with a lot of the issues that we've been discussing. So if you're a fan of the forum, Hy-Vee to your bookstore, you could...
Well, when can we do that? Do we know?
April 8th.
April 8th.
Yeah,
and
it's of course
calendar.
Already on Amazon as a pre-order, and I'm very proud to have a blurb from Danny Rubin, the writer of Groundhog Day, on my cover.
Oh, wow.
My work here is done. I feel I can die a happy man now.
that is a great neighborhood to be
yeah,
in.
So that's the story on that.
Right here. I think it just remains to say thank you so much to Billy Murnett. This is HollywoodByPhone.com. You can go to HollywoodByPhone.com/CSBonus and learn a little more about us. Get your free month and more calls like this. Coming up right before the Oscars, we have Linda Seeger, who's going to try to pick the winners with us and talk about her book, The Best Screenplay Goes To, which analyzes three best screenplay winners and interviews the writers of that. So that's our next call on schedule, and there may be one before. And please keep an eye out for Hollywood by Phone. You can email Chris at Hollywood by Phone with any of your questions. And lastly, Billy, as we say at Hollywood by Phone, this has been Off the Hook. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Chris. It's a pleasure.
All right. Good night.